Yeah, if you could start again, Mark. Sorry,
yeah,
I'm hoping this
really
will be it.
We're really struggling. Okay, let me just pick it up from where we were talking about the new industrial state. So in the book, The New Industrial State, one of the things that he talks about, which is really kind of interesting, is it's not absolutely specifically stated this way, but it's certainly implied, that the purpose of governments in the future is really to be a mechanism for the redistribution of wealth that maintains a buying class. So the role of government then becomes to tax the middle class, which basically gets taxed out of existence, to support the lower class, the rich are always the rich, and to meld and shape the society so that you have a buying class that is there to buy from the corporate elites who then feed products into the system. And this becomes a social system. You know, it's a unification almost of government and corporations in a way that the corporation is actually the top tier.
That's the key thing that is now changing.
Yeah,
in other words, the global multinational becomes predominant over a nationally elected government.
100%. They become the organizing mechanism for capital. And so the organizing mechanism overrides government. Government becomes just a vehicle. It becomes a mechanism for them to allocate capital within the population.
Yeah.
So it's really quite interesting because the view that these corporate elites then have is that everything in the world, all the capital in the world, all the money in the world, all the resources in the world are theirs. And all government is responsible to do is to try to
reconfigure
it. They become the mechanism of reconfiguring it in a way that suits the production of the corporates the best. Now, this isn't really new because, I mean, if you look back in time, you know, we had the South Sea Corporation. We had, you know, there was these early English corporations which sort of started the whole thing off that were virtually governments. I mean, they were given powers that were virtually governmental powers. They would go out into these areas and they would establish governorships and they were the ruling party.
Well, the Dutch East India Company was about 70% of the entire market cap at one
100%.
Point. 100%. You're talking about every bit piece of global world trade that went on between Europe and the Far East Asia was conducted by this one multinational, essentially.
100%.
Yeah.
And in fact, it was really a government.
Yeah.
So
well, they
so,
established Cape Town and South Africa, where you right now sit.
They were the guys who were actually mandating and dictating the organization of society. They just used government as a vehicle for doing it. It was sort of like, you know, well, we need a subsidiary that sort of stands apart from us and can do our bidding, so we don't get blamed, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it is, and we see more and more and more of this. And it's so evidenced because there are no mechanisms available to the public to overturn their own governments. So you vote this guy out and you vote that guy in. Who cares? Don't you find it really odd that Barack Obama is having this sort of like this open conversation about negotiating these big trade deals, and we're in July, and he's supposed to be done in November?
Yeah.
I mean, who the hell would start a major trade transaction in the last few months of their
purely
of their,
because it doesn't hinge on him in any way.
He's just a carrier
pigeon for the message.
Exactly. I don't think he's going to leave, but that's another conversation. But the point is that none of it is really being driven by proper government. This is politics, but it's real politics. This is real politics being played out. This is the power people who are using governments to establish what they want to establish, and it has to be done by law because everything operates by law. You can't circumvent law. Even one of the greatest dictators, acknowledged dictators of all times, Adolf Hitler, he had to use law to establish his regime. The Russian dictators used law to establish
Putin
the regime.
Putin is very precise on acting according to law. He's a lawyer.
Everyone, every every dictator you've ever seen in history, even the Roman dictators, even the they used law.
Have a rule, yeah, have to, rules of engagement.
To make it happen, because that's the only way you can do it. Hmm. So the law is really just a tool for the corporate elite to get done what they want to get done. And we see this over and over and over again. I mean, how is it that Bill Clinton is having a conversation with the attorney general who's investigating his wife? And there's no problem
there?
They're flaunting
the agency issue in our face, that it will cause a hoo-ha on social media and indignant people, and it'll just be allowed to die down. There is no scandal nowadays. There is no skullduggery that can't just be waited off and ground down to being largely forgotten nowadays. It's almost that we've been trained to accept such a high level of corrupt behavior that there's so much of it to choose from, and it's so ongoing that... It's just a mill that keeps churning out new. You can't fascinate for too long on any one issue, because there'll be another as big or bigger just along. And there's nothing that leads to censure anymore. And this started for me, particularly it accelerated. It got people accepting that the system is bent and that they are the marks. And I know it's existed long before, but particularly with the lack of bankers being jailed with the subprime fraud. Basically, they co-opted an entire bailout, a sector that privatizes its profits and is already exceedingly wealthy, socialized its costs. And there's been no consequence at all, apart from a couple of Punch and Judy shows for media. There's been no jail time for the heads of Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, any of the German banks. So it just leaves people thinking that there is a two-tier legal system for people that are of the 1%. And they keep reinforcing that message. In other words, law, they have the law to crush you and I. I'm a dissenter and a terrorist for questioning government's opinion, potentially. And they could take me down.
Exactly.
But they can't. They have no interest in Clintons. The Clintons are such criminals, from drugs running in Arkansas right the way through to actual being remarkably dangerous to be near to. The amount of people who've popped off dead that at some time worked in legal companies and gotten away with various documents. I mean, there's a full historical YouTube on Hillary Clinton and all the skeletons in her closet, but they are huge with the Clinton family. But they are there because the people know their sins and know they are a kept entity and know they will play the game. So it is just a mafia by another name, isn't it?
It is. Well, yeah. I mean, it's even the mafia was actually established to fight government. So it was meant to be more of a government of the people.
Yeah.
And that's how it all started. So, I don't know what the word for something that's worse than mafia is. I guess it's government.
Mafia was the antithesis to the original thesis of government.
Exactly.
Unrepresentative government then led to mafia, a more blue-collar, spit-and-sawdust approach to fixing a problem that wasn't quite going your way with government officials. And in some ways, I respect that, but a whole bunch more. It's great. It's incredible. And so the corporation is the vehicle of choice to asset strip. So the national silver, which could be institutions like the health service that provide, are actually going to be stripped down to being corporate contractors, outsourcers of contractors. It'll just become an empty shell that is a relay station for outsourcing to various medical contractors, I expect. Is that a likelihood
I think we see that taking place all over the place. You know that the CIA outsources 70% of their budget now? So, the CIA.
Yeah. Well, Snowden was part of the NSA, but he was doing it through a consultants company. What was the? Was
there
it Bain?
You go.
Wasn't he with Bain?
He was with McKinsey and Company, I think.
No,
so
I'm not sure that's accurate.
Oh no, he wasn't McKinsey. No, he wasn't McKinsey. You're right.
McKinsey's the big corporate heads. But anyway, the key point is there's a lot of very confidentially signed up consulting companies that do government parastatal work. including intelligence.
100%. It's funny.
We even outsource the army. I mean, the
Black
Ops.
There you
ops,
go. That's the point. That really is the point. The point is that.
Halliburton is actually an outsourcing company. I mean, they provide the McDonald's for the soldiers in Iraq. You know, but they're not the provider. They're just the contract outsourcer to the people that do construct it. And when it comes to oil, they're in oil.
Yeah, exactly.
They're in oil games.
Government is really becoming sort of redundant, aren't they?
Well, yeah, it is. It's been hollowed out. It's been hollowed out to a massive corporatocracy that is just a contractual hub for allocating the public purse's money to other private companies.
Exactly. So it kind of proves the point that, I mean, fascism, if you want to call it fascism, fascism is what's overtaking the world. And
the corporate fascism. Because you can be a CEO far longer than you can be a prime minister.
Fascism is defined as government being in cahoots with the corporatocracy. That's what defines fascism. And you're exactly right. You see, the permanent government in all over the world, particularly in the United States, that permanent government is always in power. It never leaves. And corporations have permanent government. You know, the people that are in power, they're in power as long as they decide to be in power, or unless there's some moves to move them out. But, you know, there's very limited mechanisms to overturn these power structures. And this is what we're facing. We're facing an embedded power structure. Although, at the same time, this is being uprooted by the changing economy, the drive to the marginal cost line, new technology. So there's a conflict taking place. I mean, and the Taoist would say that the one side has risen so far that the other side is beginning to rise, you know, to meet it. And that's what I think we're seeing. I think we're seeing massive structural changes in society. But the stuff that's on the surface, Brexit and all that sort of thing, there's no reason for me to believe that that's a legitimate move of the people. No reason for me to believe it at all.
And even if they did, in the unlikely event, trigger the Article 50, we will be sold a negotiation that will have all the hallmarks of still being an EU member, just not in name.
Yeah. How do you become a virgin again? You can't.
Yeah.
And the truth, as we highlighted, the truth is that there's got to be so much that's taken place that is around the idea of integration that should never have happened, that the people never got a chance to vote on. Because when they became part of the EU, they were joining an economic union. They weren't joining a super state. So are they like, what, 90% of the way to a super state now and you don't even know it?
The next major leg is EU army. We've seen a lot of movements for that.
100%
Germany.
We've shared articles on that. They're moving to that. If with all that's taking place in the world, it's become very obvious that NATO is outdated. NATO is like a joke. NATO is about ready to fall apart. The United States will probably pull out at some point in time. And what do you replace it with?
Yeah, loose cooperation between the U.S. Army and the EU Army.
Well, you certainly wouldn't want to have a situation where you have the EU with no centralized army, would you? And if the EU forms some sort of a NATO, well, then it's – I mean, what's the difference between that and a national army?
Yeah, I personally prefer the independent states with their own military capability, of course. But
Well, I prefer independent states as well. But the globalists don't seem to want independent states.
No. This is all about breaking down of national identity and clustering together. Now, we did explore in our previous discussion that they could just manage through corporatocracies, even if the Brexit's led. Let's say other states vote out, and neither of us see this happening, but let's say they are let out and that the whole EU structure actually sinks as we know it now, and other nation states vote out. There is still a way that the globalists will control everything because of this TTP approach and the corporatization of everything. In other words, even if fragmented back into nation states, allowing everyone to think that they're free again and making their own laws, the big corporations will be even more able to bully a nation state because they'll be smaller and fragmented. And they will have the power of the lobbyist, and they will sweep the national governments under the carpet and get their way anyway.
Yeah. We're in an interesting time. We're in a very, very interesting time. I say that because I fully expect there to be a pushback of some sort. There's going to be something that brings the balance, because that, in my mind, is a step too far. It's not balanced anymore when you get to that point. It's just not balanced. And the world must remain balanced. So maybe that's the result of that imbalance is going to be a world war. Maybe it's going to be, you know, who knows? You know, a meteor strikes us from the sky. I don't know. But something will come into effect that brings the balance. It always
And the
does.
Question everyone always asks, and it's almost, I find it almost impossible to answer, but you and I spoke about the mathematics. How much time? We know that the U.S. can't really go on a major tightening interest rate cycle. Their debt's too high. We know no nation really can go on a debt tightening. So we know we're on what we call intensive care monetary policy indefinitely until reset occurs. Will the Brexit be used as a quantitative easing printing game again?
It's so hard to know, Francis. You know, I mean, the it's obvious that they want to destroy the national currencies as well. That's obvious. And the best way to destroy national currencies is to just print the hell out of it so that it loses value. That's the best way to get
rid
of it.
But if everybody's doing it simultaneously, the relative valuations
Well, see, that's
don't
kind
vary.
Of that, yeah, well, that's sort of the best way to destroy it, isn't it?
Because it's hidden in a way.
Yeah, everybody's going down. The whole thing is deflating instead of one part of the boat.
Since we've called around $13, we've been accumulators of silver on an investment, not a trading with leverage strategy, on an investment strategy. Silver went through $20 up to $20.2 today. On $13, that represents the better part of over 50% increase in the last few years, and has now theoretically and technically ended its bear run post hitting 49 in the height of 2011. So we are now over with that pullback move that originally started way down at $4 when gold was at $257 with the Greenspan era of liquidity that saw us run up to 1900 on gold and 49 on silver. We've then had our first 3.5 year pullback, and I believe now we're back on the bull train for our precious metals, which is, I suppose,
100%.
When it comes to our telling people what to do, own assets was one of your key calls. Own assets, own the McDonald's rather than own the shares in McDonald's was one of the statements you made last time, which I like. And also your insurance policy against paper, which is your tangibles. And
100%. You
know, with 3,000 plus, I would say more than 3,000, 10,000, 15,000 years when we get a real history about Egyptology, etc., on gold and silver. But anyway, unique properties, rarity, value of exchange, doesn't rust, doesn't rot. It's got to be.
There's never been a time in human history where gold has not been accepted as a currency. Never.
Yeah.
Anywhere.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty important thing. There's never been a moment in time in any place in history where gold was not accepted as a currency.
Yeah.
As an exchange of value, anyway.
I would prefer to be paid in silver coins by my clients, if any of them listening out there.
Yeah.
I'll take the equivalent of any courses or trading education in silver coins as preference every single day, all day long, and I'll dump my fiat for it, because that's in effect what I'm largely doing anyway. And I look forward to the day where I just have to do much less transaction costs, flipping into fiat and flipping back out of it and losing all the money, and the fact that I get negative interest rates on it and transaction costs for moving money around, and then having to pay 25% more on my silver because it's just a ripoff. You know, the coins, it's roughly 25% over spot that you pay when you buy coins.
Yeah, yeah. There's probably some rationale for that. So, I mean, depending on the coins you buy, coins in a lot of instances are actually currency. And so there's no tax. There's no
VAT. It does give you a little bit of additional protection, yes.
So, I mean, there's probably a reason for that.
But post a reset, in terms of capital gains, you would get capital gains protection on that. The value of it, if it is deemed currency, is that which is denominated on the coin, not the intrinsic value.
Well, that's exactly why when we talked about the perfect scenario or the perfect portfolio, if I can call it that. And in my mind, the perfect portfolio is assets that are real assets that generate revenue, but don't have to be generating that revenue in a currency. I mean, you can exchange anything for it. And you have gold and silver as a liquidity buffer. So it enables you to kind of move things around. It gives you that liquidity so that you can actually get chicken feed for the chickens if you need it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And limited amount, just to cover running costs of your business affairs in bank accounts, run higher on cash than you typically do, and run even higher on the cash equivalents in gold and silver, and continue to accumulate on that side.
Right now, wealthy people are converting fiat currencies into real assets in a big way. And they're also getting out of paper assets, and they're moving into real assets.
I had a big purchase that I made in cash recently, and I had to go draw notes from the bank. One of the interesting things were every single note, and this purchase ran into thousands, was new in serial number order.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen every day, and I'm sitting here thinking, how much quantitative easing on the cash front has having to go on? If you've been quantitative easing on the digits in the computer, which is easily created, you dilute your relative holdings of cash. Cash is only normally, it used to be 11%. Now it's about 7% of total money in circulation. We know there's a war on cash, but if you keep it chronically increasing, you do still have to expand your cash somewhat, because eventually the cash is getting too tight. When you can't facilitate withdrawals anymore on the same level, you might have a cash squeeze, which will cause a run. So you have to do some printing of new notes, even just to maintain an existing percent when you're creating a certain amount of money. So here we have an example of issuance of new notes. And I just rarely have I ever been to a bank that I've had a double digit in tens of thousands of all notes.
Well, living in Africa, I can't remember a time when I've gone to the bank and not gotten new notes.
Wow.
because it's always the same point that you're making. You see, for cash to remain a certain percentage of the, of the amount of total money supply. They have to keep expanding. So, we're
so there is actually inflation. What I always keep trying to point to everybody is that people misunderstand the principle of inflation. They think inflation is when prices go up. Inflation actually is currency destruction. Anytime you expand the amount of currency, you are inflating. All that happens is you may not immediately notice it because there's been a reduction in circulation and economic activity. So sometimes the delay occurs before you get the price increases. But eventually you get the price increases. Now people will say, we've had ages when you haven't had it. Well, we've had an absolutely moribund global economy where, the Baltic Dry Index has collapsed. A whole bunch of things have collapsed. There's a lot less activity. So that's countervailing forces. It's kind of like the global warming and global dimming. If without the global dimming, we would be globally warming a lot higher. The global dimming is kind of the slowdown in economic activity, and it's the monetary policy and the fiscal policy and all of these things that are masking to a degree. The austerity means less government expenditure, so that has anti-inflationary effect, the overall downturn in economic activity and the velocity of movement of the currency has an anti-inflationary effect. But when we return to a normal average, we'll get the outcome of inflation, which is the price increases at a later point. But then you've stored up so much rollover. It's kind of like a turbo lag. You hit the accelerator and nothing happens for a while. So you hit it harder and longer and deeper. And then when the power comes on, you get whiplash. And this
that's a good example. I mean, the pure definition of inflation is going to be the amount of currency that is reflected of the same amount of assets. So if assets haven't, if assets increase at the same rate as the money supply, it's not inflationary. But if the money supply increases in advance of the increase of the asset base, that's inflation.
That would be deflationary. The assets are not going as fast. It would be the other way around, wouldn't it? When the assets
I'm talking about the pure definition of what inflation is.
Oh, okay.
See, the pure definition of inflation is too much money chasing too few goods,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that means
That's the expansion of the monetary supply ahead of the assets. Yeah.
Ahead of the assets, right?
Which now, then causes an asset price bubble, which is what we have in the stock market.
100%.
Yeah.
And see, the interesting thing is that I think you hit the key word on the head. The issue is velocity of money.
Yeah.
Because see, the velocity of money is what determines prices. So if I'm pumping money into the system, but it's not turning.
And it's all going to one, it's rebalancing bust banks. You've got zombie banks that are hemorrhaging blood. It's like pumping blood in transfusion in one arm, and they've got their arm severed on the other side. And it's pumping in, and it's just trying to clot a dead body, basically. So
yeah.
we're not feeling it. It's building up
on the
balance sheet.
You don't experience it. Now, when I was in university, I was taking an economics class way back in the 1970s. And we were experiencing this to a smaller degree. And I said to the professor, listen, this is, we have inflation and recession at the same time. And he said, it's impossible. I said, but it's happening. No, it's impossible. It doesn't exist. Well, of course, a year later, they termed stagflation. And obviously, the professor said, okay, yeah, well, a year later, he would be willing to accept that. But at the time, there was no mechanism for it. So we haven't heard the term stagflation for a very, very, very long time. But it is, in fact, what we're experiencing.
Absolutely,
we're experiencing this massive growth in money supply and no growth in assets. None.
I identified that stagflationary point about 8 or 9 years ago. I even bought Global Stagflation, the URL, for a site that ended up being a project I never followed through on, to my great shame. The whole principle, though, is we're absolutely expanding. We are getting low growth. We're getting what I call a reverse Greenspan Goldilocks economy. It's like night follows day. You can't have, this productivity miracle. We can just pump liquidity. Everybody gets richer and there's no inflation, which was the whole Greenspan boom, and not expect the absolute converse in your reset rebalancing phase. So like night follows day. And that means actually low growth and stubbornly high inflation.
Eventually hyperinflation.
Although we can't hyperinflate for long because the debt levels are so high. Hyperinflation is getting into double digits and triple digits. The minute we get there, it's over. We can't stomach 6%. As you've done the math. We don't get to hyperinflation.
That's the point. But the principle is there. That brings us to this point where as soon as, it's sort of like, have you ever run on something until you get traction? And then as soon as you get traction, it's like you fall, because you're slipping, and then you get traction, boom, you fall. My opinion is that's where we are in the economy. We're in this situation where there's just so much vacillation. We're slipping. And sooner or later, the ducks are going to come home to roost, and all those dollars that are busy floating all over the world people are going to start to say, well, why the hell am I holding these things? And they're all going to go back to the United States because they are the American currency. And when they go back to the United States, we're going to have a problem because we can't absorb that money. There's no way to absorb it. It's an impossibility.
No, it just devalues chronically. The interesting point, though, is in the fiat game, at what rate and who will go first? You've mentioned America there. Who goes first in the value, or do they all fail together? How do you?
Well,
trade
I think
that?
I think that that's the war that's on. If you follow Rickards, that's it's not really what Rickards is talking about, but you could postulate from him that's the war. It's
do you trust Rickards war. Because he's got he makes big store of his CIA. Connections. I wonder if he's not a held out entity. He's a controlled opposition.
Well, I think that what he says makes sense to me.
Some of what he says makes sense, but some of it is very anti-Putin and very rah-rah American.
Well, I don't pay attention to that. What I pay attention to is, you know, when he starts talking about things that aren't, you know, factual or whatever, I don't even listen. I don't read it. It's like, okay, yeah, next thing, you know.
It's his bias and his opinion. Yeah, but I think he does try and nurture that, you know, we've got to fight Russia and, you know,
he's got to sell books. Yeah. But what he talks about fundamentally is this currency war.
Yeah.
And I do believe that we are in a currency war. I think that everybody is trying to see who can bankrupt the other one fastest and who can get
out-export by virtue of destroying currency and get a better economic outcome in the shrinking pie game.
Well, it might be just that. This might be a bunch of really sick individuals who think this is hilarious and are playing a game and seeing, you know, okay, well, who's going to win this game with all of the people, you know, the 7 billion of us sitting around going, well, we're the victims of this game, but it's just a game. But nonetheless, it's very obvious that there is a game. This is going on.
But could it be argued that they all inadvertently reluctant participants by virtue of circumstance? There's too much debt that's been created. There's not enough economic activity. They all want to export their way out of the problem. So everybody wants their goods to be cheap, globally competitive, and doesn't want too much buying in of others because that requires too much outflows of foreign exchange. So you want a low import, you want a high export, and boom, boom, bosh, everybody wants the same thing. And hence the Brazilian financial minister's declaration of a currency war and Jim Rickards' theme. In other words, it's just competitive devaluation to try and maintain a semblance of domestic appeasement for economic activity, at least in the export space.
It's hard to understand it in any other context other than war. Pure war. It's hard to understand it in terms of, you know, what drove all this to happen.
I see it as just competition, really, more. Everybody wants to compete in an export market.
Competition is war. Competition is one group trying to best the other.
I feel intrinsically uncomfortable with the war on this and the war on that and currency war. I think that there's a psychological incentive for people to be using that phrase too often, and I wonder if we're being programmed and prepared for global real war by the continual war on drugs.
That is entirely possible. I am a student of war, and I've had more or less formal training in this area, and the actions that are being taken, they sound and look and smell an awful lot like war. You know, they sound and look and smell a lot like the beginning shots of war, because war is fought on many levels now.
Of course, many levels. It's financial. It's going to be technological, and hacking is going to be a large part of it. And it also could end up physical, which is the conventional war, which is what we all fear. But I think what's the chance they do a total global reset on the financial debt markets and blame it on a hacking event?
I think that's a probably high probability.
It's a great way of saying, hey, you know, shit, we didn't know how to do this. This ISIS group got some, or the Russians or the Chinese, you know, awesome programmers. They managed somehow to hack their way into every bank, and all your bank records are gone, and, you know, shit, we just have to start again.
I always felt that Y2K was the greatest opportunity for organized crime that ever existed.
That was never taken.
Every banker in the world could have robbed their bank blind and blamed it on Y2K.
The millennium bug.
Yeah, you know, I suppose the reason they weren't able to do it is because in the end it wasn't proven to be real. But if, you know, if everybody had actually sort of stayed that course, and if they had actually created a scenario, I mean, I'm the head of the bank.
That's an interesting example. You know, if Y2K was coming up in the next 2 years, I would say they would have taken that one with both hands, wouldn't they? They would have reset this whole bingo game and smashed all the pieces off the table and said, start again.
I don't know why they didn't do it in 2000, to be honest with you.
Yeah, we were already deep in the hole then. I mean, you could see where we were going.
Not quite as deep, but we were deep, you know? I mean, so It's I don't understand why they didn't do it then. It's hard for me to understand why they didn't. I suppose it was just too transparent that it wasn't real. And so because it was too transparent that it wasn't real, well, maybe it wasn't the, you know, it wasn't the going to be the smoke screen that they had hoped for. But yeah, I could see something like that happening. I could see, I mean, there's a lot of different scenarios that I could see taking place that would sort of facilitate a collapse. You know, a lot of scenarios. I'm expecting some scenarios in the U.S. You know, stuff I really can't talk about. But I'm expecting some scenarios that, you know, before the end of the year, that will facilitate martial law and no America leaving and no Obama leaving office. I mean,
I've had that one put to me a few times. It's almost too strong a rumor for me to think it'll happen. It's almost like, you know, the what was it that we were all supposed to die in 2012? Everyone was talking about it. The Mayan calendar or whatever the case may be. Whenever there's too strong of a rumor that's being manipulated, it just seems to never quite materialize. But I have heard that one put forward.
And I accept that. I mean, I accept that, you know, whenever people are talking about something, it's never going to happen.
Yeah, but I mean, 9/11, no one saw coming. And there was no, I wouldn't say for the layman in the street, there was much chatter.
I can't really speak to that. I mean, we did have a couple of attempts on the World Trade Center prior to that.
In 93. Yeah, many years before.
So,
but I'm just saying pre-event, like, was everyone saying, hey, I have this uneasy feeling. I think there's going to be a major terrorist event occurring. You know, I didn't get that same level of chatter. I might have been less observant than I am today. But anyway, yeah, interesting.
I also think that, you know, you have to kind of look at the political environment. And, you know, we're in this really unusual situation in the United States where the two
there's
people
never a good handover between a two-term president, is there?
Well,
it's a great time for a bit of nonsense.
Look at who's running for president. I mean, we've got two really unusual characters running for president. I think, you know, vast majority, I'm not an Obama fan, but I think a vast majority of the Americans would be quite happy to say, geez, okay, well, you know, we don't want Hillary, we don't want Trump. So, I mean, he's an alternative that we could live with. They'd almost be excited to see martial law, you know, imposed. You know, there'd be a segment of the people that would be quite happy to have things stay the way they are. I don't think they're smart. I don't think they're particularly enlightened people, but nonetheless, they would be happy.
Yeah. I think it was Nostradamus that said that there would be what everybody understood to be a black leader of the superpower of the nation when the beginning of the real end of the end, you know, it was quite apocalyptic. But I think that does point to also the possibility of an Obama extension, if depending on people's interpretation, because his writing was quite cryptic, to be fair. So,
yeah. Anyway. I'm not an expert. I don't know. I just know that I look at the politics of the country. I look geopolitically at what's going on.
He was a hope candidate, and people really felt refreshed to just be not Bush and to get someone like him. And there was the civil rights angle and everything that had actually re-engaged people politically. These two are like, she's a subhuman completely. I don't think she has a genuine emotion that she ever shows. She's almost like a little soulless witch, I call her. And Trump is just exceedingly divisive character, which some people will vote for in spite of, to piss their liberal mates off. So, I mean, he would get support, but it's just a none of the above. They both, in their different ways, appear to be high system guys.
Yeah.
Particularly Hillary.
Well, need I say more? You know, it's like, who do you choose? You know, do you choose the frying pan or the fire? You know, which one do you want? Well, there's another alternative. Just don't go to near the stove, and that's, you know, that's keep Obama. Oh, I mean, legally he can't stay. Well, he can only stay if there's martial law. And there are lots of circumstances where that could take place. Lots of circumstances.
Yeah. So you're anticipating in your as a possibility, and I love the game of looking forward and being a futurist, because this is the only way you can have run scenarios in your mind and have a plan for that event. Possibility of an event that triggers martial law in the U.S. before the presidency is decided.
Yeah, I expect it.
Wow. Interesting one. You can't say we don't put our neck out on this
podcast. No, I mean, you know, that does sound crazy. I could probably give a lot of justification, but I probably wouldn't be alive tomorrow if I did. I just have a very strong feeling.
I'd love to think we're that relevant and that feared, Mark, that we need fear for our lives.
Well, you know, you never know who's listening to anything.
They're all listening to everything, but they probably don't have the time and patience. They've got some computer listening for keywords.
And the problem is my background makes me particularly vulnerable.
Yeah.
So, I can't really comment on it. But I have an expectation that there will be something that happens. Now, it's entirely possible that doesn't happen. And it's entirely, there's all these sort of things. None of which changes the fundamentals of what we've spoken about in terms of
Lionel Messi missed a penalty the other day in the Cup Array in South America. But I'm afraid that doesn't make him a bad footballer. You could be wrong, but that doesn't make you an idiot. Yeah, absolutely. And the whole game is about taking a chance at being wrong and being out there. And that's what I like. And I admire your guts.
It doesn't change the fundamentals. I'd still rather own a McDonald's than McDonald's shares. And I would still rather, and I still would like to own some gold and silver, regardless. Absolutely. You know, it doesn't have to be a cataclysm for me to want those things. I think that's sound. In the current environment, I think it's sound. In the amount of whipsaws that we're seeing in marketplaces, I think it's sound. In light of the fact that there's so much volatility in the paper assets, I think it's sound. Yep. And the great thing is that it's sound no matter what happens. You know, it's sound if Obama stays as president. It's sound if Hillary Clinton is president. It's sound if it doesn't matter. It's sound if Brexit is completed, and it's sound if it isn't. It doesn't matter. It's a sound foundation to be on in the current environment. And the evidence is there for that. The evidence is there. It says, look, own assets that have cash flows or can be made to cash flow. There's something you have control over, direct control over. It's not a paper asset. And own something else that is a proven vehicle of exchange that you can use in the event that fiat capital or fiat money loses its value. Why is that such a, you know, that's not, what's wrong with that?
No,
you know,
spot on.
If this was 1963, I'd say, well, that's probably a little bit extreme. But today's world, no. I think it's really sound. I mean, it's ground I'm not afraid to stand on. And I would, you know, it gives me the ability to make all these ridiculous predictions and all these out there thoughts, because it doesn't matter. What I said is sound.
What about the trade on the martial law idea? Dollar down on that or dollar strong?
Ooh,
I mean, it could, you know, you would think down, but that's sometimes wrong, your immediate response.
People could see
the strength of government. It could see postponement of a difficult decision. It could seem like leadership. It could seem like, you know, a real tightening up of grip. Is it going to be a negative dollar event or a positive dollar event? Martial law in America.
Where do you move for protection? Right?
Gold.
I mean, obviously gold.
It'll cause a panic, and it'll be a buying in gold. And if gold and silver goes up, invariably it means people trading out of dollars. I would think weak.
It's really hard to know, because it's hard to see how people perceive it. It depends on what precipitates it. If what precipitates it is, you know, a natural disaster, then maybe not. If what precipitates it is some sort of political or military or terrorist move in the United States, well, then, you know, there might be a rush to safety, and they might see the dollar is safe. You know, it all depends on how people think the United States is going to come out of it. So,
do you see it as a U.S.-based event or a U.S. response to
outside
event?
I see it U.S.-based.
Yeah. Yeah, because to be martial law, it invariably implies that it's an internal matter.
100%.
Yeah, but I just wanted to ask, sometimes you might think, you know, if something happened in Mexico or Canada or something like that.
No,
and there
it's an internal event. It's an internal event. It's something that facilitates the need for that action. And I mean, it's not like it's never happened before. It's not like we haven't had martial law declared in various states of the United States. So it's not that irregular. How the dollar reacts to it, that's an interesting That's an interesting call. I would think that, I mean, instinctively, I would say you probably see an immediate rush to the dollar, and then not very long thereafter, a flood out of the dollar.
Yes, I would see yen strength on that because it's a fiat trade, and of the paper currencies, possible Swiss franc strength, which they'll continue to try offset against appreciating against the euro, so they can intervene. So you might want to stay clear of the franc. I would say the yen, if you had to deal in paper, and I would say gold and silver.
Yeah, gold and silver.
Just everything now, everything I look at just keeps coming back to reaffirm the precious metals, you know.
Although you have to, you know, in any of these trades, you have to understand that you can't take the you can't go with the immediate price, because when we went into the last sort of invasion mode in the United States, the immediate trades were counterintuitive. You know, you would have thought the dollar would go down.
That's why I asked that. I don't know if you remember Fukushima.
And the dollar went up. Yeah, I do remember. Yeah.
Well, what actually happened is the yen appreciated.
Yeah.
Chronically.
Unusual. Yeah.
And spat it all the way down. And then and I was trading my setup, and I was long the yen against the dollar, and I was, that sounds like terrible news. Yet my trade is absolutely accelerating and spilling and made its target. And I thought, wow, I thought I was the wrong side of the market, but the market said no. I only then later concluded, well, maybe the Japanese were repatriating yen for a reconstruction product, and they were selling U.S. treasuries that they were holding to convert back into yen.
I think that's in fact what turned out. That's in fact what turned out to be the case.
Yeah.
So,
it seems how counterintuitive a crisis for a country where a currency represents the share price for that country. The automatic assumption is that it's devaluation for that currency, where the currency represents the share price of the country, but not. Not always.
Yeah, I mean, it is always counterintuitive, and I think that, you know, the important thing that, you know, that I would like, that I try to keep in mind in a situation like that, I mean, I try to avoid trading those markets if I can, but the thing that I always try to keep in mind is that when there's a shock, then you tend to get a direction and then an immediate turn of that direction.
You get a fake out play, basically. Yeah, you get the emotional response, then you get the logical response. People respond primitively when they're in fear and greed situations.
Yes.
The primitive brain first, then the logical brain. People don't stop and think and process the logical brain. They all fear at the same time, and they see other people fearing, so they stampede instead of just going straight to the logical response.
Exactly. In fact, there's a great story in one of the. I'm trying to remember the name of the book. It was Reminiscence of a Stock Operator or something related to that anyway.
Yeah.
And he talks about the earthquake in San Francisco in 1904 or 1914. I can't remember what year it was, but one of those two. And he said that, you know, he expected that this would be a rout, that the market would collapse. But the immediate reaction was a rise in the market. And he was short. So he was like, what the hell's going on? But then as... You know, after a day or so, people began to realize, well, this is really worse than we thought. As the information starts to come in and they realize that it was worse than they thought, boom, crash the other way. And then people begin to realize, oh, yeah, but they're going to have to rebuild all that stuff so the market goes the other way. You see, it's like this roller coaster that tends to go up and down, up and down, up and down, and there's no real rationale to it. There's no one direction. So... I mean, my response to your question would be that martial law, I would instinctively think, would have an immediate spike in the dollar, and very shortly thereafter, it would turn in the other direction.
Yes, I think you would get the emotional response, because what would possibly happen is people dispose of superfluous assets that may be of the depreciating variety that leads to a lot of credits into the banking system. So if everybody starts, you know, they've got three motorcycles and they suddenly decide they only need one in this fear environment, everyone sells all their additional SUVs just to get into cash. They first receive money, you know, so a lot of liquidation of things could lead to deposits in the American banking system, which could see an artificial repatriation of dollars
whatever creates the problem, assuming that that is something that involves a foreign power or something like that. People don't generally like to bet against the United States in a fist fight. So they tend to, you know, they tend to support it. And then once they see what's going on, they say maybe it's not so, you know, maybe this is a longer term problem and they're not going to be able to deal with it well, or it's going to result in this and that, then it goes the other way. So I would say initially there's a spike, then it turns the other way. And is it funny enough, it's weird, because when the dollar spikes, gold tends to turn the other direction. But I think you'd probably see a rise in gold and silver at the same time, just because
that seems part of the fiat trade.
Yeah, it seems to be what people are doing these days. They're kind of going, okay, let's buy both at the same time.
Absolutely. Mark, I don't want to make this too long. This has been awesome. Great, great speaking with you again.
Yeah, thanks, Francis. Sorry for all the hassles.
No, that's all right. We'll split it into a few parts, and there may be a small segment where we didn't get much done, which I'll lose in the middle. But the untouchable arm of the corporatocracy, your government, I really like that as a strap line. And who knows, you really put your head out there and said, hey, watch out, there's possibility of martial law in the U.S. I have heard that one echoing down the fringe media. It'll be a real interesting one if it does happen. And that will mean neither Hillary nor Obama, nor Trump.
Yeah. There's no election.
Yeah. In other words, it just ends. And would that be possibly an assassination attempt on Trump?
I don't even want to speculate.
I've heard that one too.
I think that we are likely to see some sort of event. Now, I mean, I could be completely wrong, but it would, put it this way, it would really shock me if we ended up in January with either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton taking the oath of office. That would really shock the hell out of me. I'd be stunned that took place. Now, it doesn't mean it can't happen, but it would be shocking to me.
Interesting. That's great. I'm going to let you go. Thank you for the second cup to get in the can.
Thanks, Francis.
First time. I'll post links for you, and if you can share it down the way, that'll also be awesome.
Thanks, bro. Take care.
All the best, Mark. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks.